Hi folks, this is our latest podcast with the Sinn Féin leader Mary Lou MacDonald as part of our Tortoiseshack Live in Lockdown podcast series. These have been terrific. It's been great to be joined by our members, our supporters, and the participation has been top notch. The questions are always fabulous and I am doing my best to try and put them to the guests as we get them. If you want to join us, you can head over to patreon.com/tortoiseshack. Once you register with us, guys, you will receive an idea of who the upcoming guests are and then a way to register. It's pretty simple. You click on, you come in, and you'll be able to watch us live as we conduct the interviews and even ask questions, participate, and have a bit of crack as well. It's working well, I think. I hope the feedback has been terrific. People seem to enjoy this conversation with Mary Lou, and I would anticipate we should be doing two or three more over the next two or three weeks. Some really good guests lined up. It helps us, I'm not gonna lie. We really do require people to come on board to help us out. It's cheap, it's cheap as chips. What else would you be doing for right now when we're in this situation? So it's patreon.com/tortoiseshack. Really help, and you get a bit back out of it. So talk to you all soon. Enjoy.
Welcome to the Echo Chamber podcast. My name is Tony Groves, and today we are joined live via Zoom, via lockdown, by the Sinn Féin leader, Mary Lou MacDonald. Mary Lou, thank you so much for joining us.
Not at all, Tony. My absolute pleasure. And hello to everybody who supports your brilliant podcast and this incredible platform.
Well, we really appreciate it. Listen, I'm going to go straight into it because, obviously we had to rearrange this podcast pre COVID. If you recall, we were trying to get it done pre disaster, shall I put it? And I was thinking back on what that meant to me and what it's meant in terms of the democratic process. And it seems to me that democracy is not what you have; democracy is what we do. And I put it to you, very big, very broad question to begin. What is it that you want to be known to have done?
Right, that is a big question. I think for me, possibly the most important thing is to, on the one side of the coin, to be very true to myself, to what I believe, to where I believe we can go, not to second guess yourself or get complacent, to use the word of the day. And to do that and at the same time represent people and represent working class interests, represent the values of social justice and equality, and to do that honorably and to bring lots and lots of people and meet lots and lots of people along the journey. So for me, it's you're asking about democracy, Tony, and you can weigh things in terms of outcomes and achievements, you know. Mm. So for some people in political life, it's a question of achieving high office, or for some people in life generally, it's about accumulating a lot of wealth, or for others, it's about writing the great novel or making the great, you know, it's product. But in all of these things, there's process involved as well. So it's not what you do, it's the way that you do it. The process piece really, really matters in activism, and really, really matters when you particularly set your sights very high and your goals very high, and when you're involved in activism, which is a collective activity. So it doesn't, to achieve the kind of things I want to achieve, doesn't lend itself comfortably to kind of any egotistical sense of my great gift to the universe. You know, it doesn't yeah, lend itself in that way. And that's not how I go about my politics or my work. But that for me is important. Very, very important to be authentically yourself and to bring that authentic self with others to change the world, really. That's my ambition. A modest ambition.
I went as big with the question to open, but I suppose just if I could drill down into that for a second. And we are living in it's a very unusual time. Look how we're doing this. The last time we met, we were having a cup of tea. And now we're doing this across the internet. But the society had already had inequalities and injustices in it. In terms of the areas that were already left behind, and I'm looking, I see people here I know who are Gaelic speakers who talk about the areas of the Gaeltacht that have been left behind. Mm-hmm. In terms of what you want to do post COVID, and I do want to look forward in this interview post COVID. What specifically would you like to do for the areas that are finding that they were left behind already?
Yeah, I think it's important to that we understand that in a sense, this public health emergency, this global epidemic has changed everything in some really, really profound ways for us as societies, as community, as family, and as individuals, of that there's no doubt. But we also, I think, need to grasp that the things that were hardwired into our system and our society, the outcomes and the manifestations of inequality that we had 6 months ago and a year ago and 10 years ago are still with us.
Yeah.
So everything has changed on one level, and yet nothing has changed either. So to take it in the framework, say, of very recent politics, I mean, we had a general election and we talked about a whole range of things. We talked about housing. We talked about public housing. We talked about rent freezes and controls. We were told they couldn't be done. By the way, they've now been done. It has now happened. We talked about our health system. We talked about public health, all of those things. And a really important thing happened in that election, because whole swathes of opinion said very clearly, we are ready now for that. We are now ready to take that step.
500,000 people at least.
In the case of Sinn Féin, and much beyond that, because let's face it, we had a great day out. It was a very significant mandate, but it wasn't just for us. I mean, it was for other parties and voices that support that politics too. And then along comes this crisis. But the truth is that those things that were so important on the run into the election and on election day are even more important now. So to take housing, Tony, and you and I have talked about housing and,
yep,
you know, at length before. This crisis underscores why it is that housing and shelter is a human right, because it is your sanctuary. And in the grip of a public health emergency where we're told to isolate, self-isolate, physically distance, keep your distance. You can't do that if you don't have stable, appropriate accommodation. So to all the naysayers who said, oh my God, here's the left again, whinging, and they want free houses and all this crack. That's not where it's at all. You see, a society that doesn't provide safe, stable, appropriate accommodation for its people isn't a safe society. And it takes a public health catastrophe, an emergency not seen for a century, to actually drill that point home. So those of us that have argued, for example, for a referendum to make the right to housing a constitutional, a mentioned, listed, explicit constitutional right, it's not just for the glory of that, or it's not to have an argument with the existing status quo and the system. It's because stable societies, safe societies, demand that the basic things, the basic needs, human needs and democratic rights of citizens are recognized. So it is a case, to use my little bit of French, plus ça change, plus c'est la même chose. Everything changes, nothing changes. But let me say this, Tony, I honestly believe if we can stay the course, and if we can hold on to the momentum that collectively people built into February and beyond it, I actually believe that we can use this punctuation point now in our story as a huge, huge opportunity to change things, you know, for the better for everybody. It can also become a punctuation point that gets grabbed by others and that turns the clock back and brings us back a decade to more cutbacks and austerity and that diet of destruction. And we have to be very, very determined as citizens, as activists, as people who care about our society, as people of principle. I think we have to do everything we can to seize the momentum and to keep the momentum and to keep that sense of purpose and energy.
Can I come in on that? Because what's important on that, we have been running our pods for the last number of weeks, and we've spoken to, and there's people on this very chat who we've had on as guests who've spoken about the idea of no going back, no going back in terms of, you know, and I suppose we were very lucky to talk to Cleanly Kialig, the infectious diseases doctor in James's, and she spoke to us about an individual who she would see regularly come in, and she hadn't seen for a few weeks because he was actually getting adequate housing for the first time in years, and he referred to it as like living in MTV cribs.
Yeah.
Now, whether it be in opposition or it be leading a government, how do you feel about pushing to make sure that these things that have now become into fruition that we couldn't do previously, how do we unsee them and how do we make sure they don't get pushed back?
We stand our ground. I mean, it was never a case. Let's be absolutely clear. When we in Sinn Féin, for example, and our spokesperson, Eoghan Brin, set out a very ambitious program for public housing, for affordable housing, including extensive measures to protect renters. Everybody said, no, that can't be done. No, that can't be done. It almost became like a mantra. That can't, that's fine. It's a great idea, but it can't be done. All of those things could always be done. Always. There was never a point at which a government or people in charge were prohibited from taking the decisions to do the right thing by communities and by, for example, that man that Cliona referred to when you spoke to her. So that's why for us the issue of being in government and leading the government really matters, because you're right, Tony, to say whether in government or whether in opposition, we will stand our ground on these issues and we will press and push. And if Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael think that they can, you know, kiss and make up and have some wee cosy arrangement and fob people off for the next 2 or 3 years or whatever length they have in mind, they're very much mistaken, because they will meet in that scenario with a very strong and I hope quite a united opposition benches and pressing for these things. But for now, in the here and now, I'm not conceding for a second that they have it all stitched up and they have it all their own way. Far from it. I think really we have to understand that For the right things to happen, we need to position ourselves in the strongest possible way to deliver those things. So I still want a government of change. I want Sinn Féin driving that, leading that. But I want it to include those strands of Irish politics that have credibility and a track record and a real commitment and a real appetite to deliver the things that we need. Be in no doubt this can be a moment of sort of a big leap forward, or it can be a slide back moment. And
can I just come in there and just take the opportunity? Thanks for coming on and having the chat with us. Happy birthday. I know it's...
Oh my.
And may we be the first to wish you. I know it's a couple of days away. Happy birthday. And you're younger than me, so that's all that matters.
Well, I'm delighted to hear that, Martin. It's great to be younger than somebody. I'm a May Day baby. I was born on Labor Day, and I always joke with my mum and say it was literally Labor Day for her.
Yes,
so thanks
that's
so
right.
much. That's very kind. Thank you.
In that context, you're the most powerful, the most successful female politician in Ireland. You've beaten the old boys' school. You gave the idea of roofs over people's heads, a decent health system, decent social welfare. Now they've robbed your clothes. You're standing in the schoolyard. There's one of two gangs standing over there that you could easily work with. The other has ruled itself out. How does it feel, or do you feel that it's the fact that you're a woman in what is traditionally a male occupation, but you're a very powerful woman in a male occupation, and you get quite a lot of jibes about being a woman, about being cranky. It's been pointed out that, and you've said this yourself, the notion of a secret army council is in itself a misogynistic notion that the woman can't think for herself. And in that context, you don't get the support that other female political candidates would broadly get from the feminist movement. How does that make you feel?
Well, I think it's probably fair to say that whoever was leading Sinn Féin at this time, me or another comrade, you know, man or woman, would be getting the kind of abuse and the cold shoulder and the vilification that's being heaped on us. I mean, it's straight out of the playbook of Cumann na Gael in the 1930s, which makes it so ironic the way that Fianna Fáil go on. But you are absolutely right to say, Martin, and let me just make it clear, I'm not saying this is kind of like moving from cranky woman to whinging woman, you know.
Not like the Irish Times letter this week.
Yeah. But it is true that political life still is very, very male and very masculine. And I think the reason for that is beyond the kind of superficial thing of, you know, you turn up and you're there, you know, in the doll chamber or whatever, and you're nearly a novelty because you're a woman, you know, kind mm-hmm. of an exotic feature. It's beyond that kind of cosmetic piece in it. I think that is because profoundly power is still regarded as a very male thing, and because traditionally men have been the ones in positions of power. And as you refer to the two gangs, as you call them on the playground, as it happens, the two parties that have carved things up and had things their own way for almost a century now, as it happens, are led by two men. In fact, they've never been led by
women ever. Yeah.
So of course you'd be deeply naive not to understand that of course there's an element of gender to this. But can I let you in on a secret, Martin? The point I'm at now. I am at the point where you see people who wish to indulge in that kind of thing and who are tragically caught in that narrow, toxic kind of view of the world. I'm at a stage now where I'm too busy, we've too much to do, and it's certainly not going to stop me, and it doesn't influence in any way how I carry myself. So if I'm told someone doesn't like my voice, what can I do except say, you know, it sounds okay in here. If people don't like my politics, but that's okay. It's a democratic system. I might not like theirs.
This should be. Sorry, Mary Lou, I want to come in and say, because there must be that moment where you say, I'm sitting down with Ryan Tuberty on the Late Late, and he's introduced me as, you may not agree with her politics, but it's typical of when I have to defend Martin. I have to defend Martin online all the time. I say, I don't agree with him on anything.
If we have female candidates in any other aspect, there is a rally around female candidates from other women. But that's not the case with you. You get as much against as for you. It's kind of this a pull on the feminist jersey with some people, but not with others. How does that feel?
Well, just to say to you, you see, that doesn't reflect life in its totality. I get massive, massive, massive support from women, from men too, but from women in particular, massive regard and support and warmth and kindness and good crack. And so, you know, politics is not for the faint-hearted. If you're at the front and if you put yourself out there, I mean, the fact is, if you put yourself out there, at times you're going to get blowback and you're going to get criticism sometimes that's fair. And other times you're going to get criticism and even abuse that's unfair. And if there's one of the lessons I've learned in my career as an activist and a public representative is that not to take things personally, especially your energies and so on. I think again, what you're referring to there, Martin, is still within some sections of society, just that slight discomfort because people yes. perhaps have bought into Sinn Féin's a little bit beyond the pale, you know?
Well, it's even women are on the front line, very much so in this battle that we're undergoing at the moment.
Yes.
And there aren't a huge amount of political female voices out there. There isn't a representative amount. I mean, there are more women fighting on the front line than men, but on the political front, we have far more male voices than female voices.
And that's because if you look to the front line, particularly in terms of nursing and midwifery, and front line in terms of cleaning,
retail,
and catering, that's more mixed. Their caring roles, and traditionally the way that we have been conditioned, it is conditioned that is gender appropriate, like that is, but you move up the food chain and you say, well, that's okay, but you know, we go up a couple of rungs and who's actually calling things, who's making the decisions, and you find that the gender profile changes very dramatically. It's the same in education.
Yeah,
you know, it's often quoted to me. It's primary school teaching, look at the figures, huge numbers of women.
Well,
when it comes to principal teachers, disproportionately men. And that's not an anti-male point, it's a gender policy.
But what they say it's a calling. When women are underpaid, and it's a calling, it's a vocation, whereas men have important jobs. I'm going to quickly move to, you say in we are still, and there's great people on the front line. I have a T-shirt behind me with Anna Liffey on it. I'm shouting out the friends, but they're on the front line. We have got, unfortunately, a country that relies on NGOs, on the charity sector. The safety net for people is below the poverty line. Are there tangible things that you can tell me that you would like to see that would change that?
Well, firstly, the core of this is the state discharging its functions and its obligations fully. So if you want a society in which citizens enjoy the basic human, civil and democratic rights to which they are entitled, the state, how the state is formed and how it operates is absolutely critical to that. So you're quite right. I mean, the NGOs are incredible. The community and voluntary sector are just outstanding. They're the glue that keep communities and keeps society together in many cases. But it is true to say that when you look at some very, very fundamental services for citizens, they're done at a minimum at arm's length from the state, these Section 38s and 39s, for example, or they are done on a charity model, or they're done on a voluntary model where it's you're kind of beholden to your funder year on year. So what we need to do in a big sense is move from that, even from that way of thinking, the way of thinking of citizens' rights and entitlements as, you know, things that are given as grace and favor from the system. Like we have to make a psychological leap. And then we need to resource services properly. And as a society, we have to decide, for example, I'm going to take a very basic one, and that is a functioning public health service. I mean, before we get to anything else, a functioning single tier, properly resourced health service. We have to decide as people that is what we insist on, that's the bottom line and the basic requirement. Because if the citizenry don't decide that, press for that, campaign for that, vote for it too, in the absence of that mandate, others will press for a model that's about privatization and outsourcing and all of the things that we've seen that have debilitated the delivery of our health services. So this is about understanding, and the politics of the left, you know, is often criticized because we talk about rights. And I think very often it belies a misunderstanding of when you say that we have rights that accrue to us as citizens, it doesn't mean that we don't have responsibilities.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean that anybody in this life gets a free ride. You don't. Like, there's nothing for nothing. Let's face
it. And the houses don't drop out of the sky.
Exactly. But so it means we need to be very clear in our own political vocabulary, in how we express things and what we mean. And then we have to democratize our activism as well. We have to let people in. You know, not everybody describes themselves in ideological or even political terms, but they will describe themselves very profoundly in human terms, you know, around decency and equality and fairness and respect for people. These are key values. This is key. These are key concepts for us. To create the kind of momentum that we're going to need.
One value that I think is lacking, particularly in political life, is accountability. And I suppose accountability is not really a value, more of a checks and balance thing. But in terms of an anti-corruption agenda, would you support an anti-corruption office as such?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I think we have on the face of a different state agencies that are dedicated in different ways.
Yeah, but they don't have powers. They don't have teeth.
Exactly. It's about teeth. I mean, I found myself, even in the course of my own parliamentary work back in the day when I was on the Public Accounts Committee, and I think we had some successes at that time in at least bringing visibility to issues and getting the narrative told. But the truth is very often that there is a lack of any sanction, enforcement, and you find that across kind of the different regulatory arms of the state. So this is something that we need to address. I don't have a fix for you in terms of what form that might take, except to say to you that kind of corporate accountability, but then accountability for people in public life, accountability. I mean, we're in a situation now where the Dáil is meeting once this week. I think we start meeting twice next week. We're very conscious of our obligations to bring accountability and answers and an open debate at this time.
If I can on that, you sent a letter yesterday, or you wrote a letter yesterday about involving everybody in the conversation, about discussions about reopening or lessening off on lockdown. Are you concerned at the moment that money is buying access, and that access is now looking to restart before we are ready to restart?
I am concerned if it is a case that wealth would trump health in this scenario. Yes, I mean, I'm concerned. And look, let's just acknowledge and say it out loud. The restrictions that have been in place are extraordinary. I mean, in normal circumstances, let's be honest, guys, in normal circumstances, if the state moved that you couldn't go beyond 2 kilometres outside of your house,
we'd be fine.
Let me tell you, three of us would be the first in line to argue.
Yeah, absolutely.
But we are in an extraordinarily dangerous situation. So we need these extraordinary measures. My letter to Leo Varadkar was really to say to him, look, we've heard a lot of pipeline. I think there's been a bit of finger pointing at the population, which I think is wrong. I think people have rallied magnificently. We've mentioned the frontline staff, but beyond that, people in their own families and homes, sometimes in very difficult circumstances, very tense circumstances, have pulled together and have risen to the challenge. The shortfalls that are now in place are ones that need to be met by the government. We don't have a proper testing and tracing system. That's mm-hmm. not the citizens' fault, that's the system's fault. So I wrote to him saying there are a number of things that we need to sort out. We need, including, by the way, absolute assurances, proper oversight and enforcement of health and safety measures as and when, whenever it is that it's safe for people to go back to work. And I've said, you know, we need a plan, and you need to trust citizens with the plan. You shouldn't be, you know, it's almost like before the budget where they're teasing people with, gosh, I wonder, will they do this or will they do that? that's entirely inappropriate at any time. But now, at this time, when you're saying to people that we are making this big ask of you, the minimum that citizens can expect is that they get transparency and that they get the full facts as the situation unfolds.
I think budget is a very good analogy to the way the information is being fed to us at the moment. And there is also an element of, you know, you didn't do enough, you didn't lock down enough. The blame has been moved over towards citizens, when really the truth is we don't have the key elements in place to do this safely. And that's the bottom line. Why do you think the narrative is to switch it over onto ordinary people?
I don't know. I mean, I can speculate that I think expectations were raised by the same government that then was given out about complacency. I think they put themselves in a difficult spot. I mean, I have the view, for what it's worth, that our people are smart enough and care enough about their families and their communities to understand when it is said this virus is massively transmissible. It is a deadly virus, potentially. We have no immunity. We have no antivirals. We have no vaccine. So therefore, we have to do very difficult things to keep people safe. And I think our citizens equally understand, if told consistently and if you have a steady approach, that, look, we now need to set in place the checks and balances, the safety nets, so that we can be sure that when we unwind and remove these emergency measures, we'll do it safely. The worst thing that can happen is that you move quickly or you move inappropriately, and then the virus comes back, perhaps mutated and more virulent, and more people are laid low and more lives are lost. You see, I trust people to get that, even in their frustration and their wish to get back to work, or their worry about their child because they're not getting social interaction and their schoolwork and their desire to see their mommy. God, I want to see mine. I haven't seen her in, you know, properly in weeks. So, I mean, I get all of that, but, you know, people really care very deeply about their families and their community. And I just think the government went ahead of itself. I think it was spin and then announcements and re-announcing.
Well, hang on, Mark, can I come in? I just want to come in on that, on the spin and announcement things, because it comes to one of the questions that we have from one of our members in terms of the media and particularly the arts. So we've seen a huge investment in communications. You know, the Taoiseach, when he became Taoiseach, said communications is a virtue. He repeated that line again, and very little by way of the arts. We have a president who is very committed to the arts, who talks about, you know, and writes eloquently, speaks eloquently. And yet we see during this crisis that, again, it's been any supports for them have really disintegrated. And, you know, if under your, where do you see a place for that in terms of our culture, our heritage, and not just, and also broadening that out into our new heritage, our new evolving Irishness?
Absolutely. Yeah. And let it be said, even though it is one of the Cinderellas of the system, the arts in Ireland drive other economic engines, not least tourism. I mean, how many people come to our wonderful island because we are a people of letters and of, you know, a Nobel laureates and of theatre and novels and poetry. So this idea that the arts is some kind of added on for us, and that's the impression I got when the government made its meagre allocation to the arts. I just thought, like, this is a bit of box ticking, or there isn't a full appreciation that Ireland without our artistic community and their output in music, in theatre, in film, you know, in audio, all of its manifestations is a much poorer place, because it's part of our identity. So I think what needs to happen is, for example, in the immediacy of government formation, we need to be sure that there is a minister with a dedicated focus on the arts. It's generally the arts, the Gaeltacht and heritage. I don't think that's a bad combination, but it has to have ambitious planning. And do you know what? Above all, it has to involve the artistic community. Like, I don't claim to be, I am not one of the, you know, immensely talented and divinely guided artists of our country. But God, I respect those that are. And I know if you want to know what the arts needs, and if you want to plan big, the first thing you do is you go and you consult. And you don't just talk and then walk away and make up your own plans. You involve the artistic community. It's ironic because in this lockdown scenario, where would we be without our books? You know, without those of us that still have vinyls, that'd be you and me, Martin, we're the album. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Gramophones.
Where would you be, like, for people who are isolating or whatever, and even myself, like, when I wasn't great, I mean, just to put on music, to, you know, to watch a drama, all of that stuff, sure. So it's not a frills piece. It's a core piece to how we, you know, live our lives, but also how it's an economic driver. It's
absolutely. I think it has huge value. And as someone who was constantly banging the drum for supporting creators, and actually one of the reasons why we decided to do these live is because we said, you know, we might give a platform, and maybe you'll see, because creators are stuck at home. They can't, they may not be able to reach their audience, and we can try and do those things. And I'm not saying we're on a level with that. I'm just saying this is the idea that we say, well, maybe this is how the world is going to be for a while. Let's just roll with the punches and see, because we need to support that. In terms of the media coverage, one of the things that stood to you guys, I believe, was that it was a short campaign, and some of the editorial lines didn't actually get to ramp up enough to head off they didn't spot the momentum coming. Post-election, so pre-election, they started with it's Leo versus Micheál, and that devolved down, and they didn't see it coming. And then when we kept talking vote left, transfer left, and it eventually became this unstoppable juggernaut, which it was. Like, there's no two ways about it. We forget how that changed Irish politics. Post that, now have you felt that the media pushback has it been, and I don't want to break, that's a very broad spectrum, no one loses a fight against the media, I just mean elements within the media that have decided, okay, that wasn't good, that might not be good for business. How do you find that as the leader of the party that actually won the last general election in terms of the popular vote?
I think predictably the establishment in all of its guises is regrouping. That was always going to happen. I mean, so I'm not hugely surprised by that at all. And you can, you know, take your pick, and you'll identify your own author of choice as to who best represents that. But of course, that's well underway, because the interests that have run things for decades and decades, for generations and generations, and who at some times have virtually have had it all their own way, and who believe that they should have, by the way, all their own way, of course, are regrouping. And for us, you see, when they see the likes of Irish Republicans coming, everybody knows that we had a conflict. Everybody knows the awful toll that exacted on people across the board who suffered grievously, including by the hands of the IRA. I've never made any bones about recognizing that. But actually, their hang-up around Sinn Féin isn't really about that. The issue here is about now. It's not about the past. It's about now. And more critically, it's about the future. And when you come and say, we are now taking a stand, you know, and when you bring the population with you and say, well, actually, we need to do things differently, you know, just to get the basics right, you're always going to get that. You're always going to get that blowback. So I'm not hugely surprised at it. It is also worth saying that that's not universal.
Yeah, absolutely.
Across what is sometimes called the mainstream media either, you know?
Are you surprised at the Fianna Fáil reaction? I'm kind of surprised at the Fianna Fáil reaction. I would have seen that Fianna Fáil and Sinn Féin are not all that far apart on a lot of issues. And Fianna Fáil are the ultimate chameleons.
Are you negotiating on air?
No, I'm just saying that the ultimate chameleons, they have proven that they can work with pretty much anybody. Do you think it's the drive for Taoiseach that's preventing any meaningful discussion between the two parties?
It might well be. That would be, you know, speculation on my part. I think I see it in this way. It's not so much that Fianna Fáil and Sinn Féin are so like, we're not really, you know,
no,
I mean,
but
we're very...
You work together quite a bit.
However, if you look at the story of Fianna Fáil and the story of modern Sinn Féin, certainly on that point, I take your point, there are similarities. I mean, people should remember, in 1926, when Fianna Fáil was formed, the IRA went with them. And I mean, yes, largely their organizational, you know, sinew across all of that was built by people who were IRA people at the time. But more to the point now, when they say, not alone will we not go into government with these guys, because we, you know, we will not speak to them about government formation. They are not fit to be in government. When you hear all that rhetoric, the most astonishing thing is that they are a party which, you know, back in the day, all of those tactics were tried against them. And they should know, therefore, that those tactics ultimately don't work, because people are wiser than that. And you know what? People are fairer than that. The public mind, for all of our faults and all of our, at times, craziness, the public mind is fairer than that, because It's not ultimately a mark of democracy to brag that you are excluding the elected representatives of a quarter of the voting public.
Well, I suppose that brings us back to my initial point. The first point was, democracy is not what we have, it's what we do. And I do feel very strongly that you know, if that is the case where we are going now, we have to offer an alternative vision for the country. So what you saw today was a letter to the Green Party that, to me, read very much of as business as usual.
Yes.
I know it's only out recently, but you know, it's fair to ask you, where do you sit on the ambitions for this nascent program for government?
Well, when I saw their initial framework document, I thought, that looks familiar. And of course it looked familiar. I mean, they cut and paste all of our work. And by our, I mean Sinn Féin, but I mean more broadly. Yeah. And I didn't think it was possible to actually write anything more vague than that until I saw the letter today. Mm. So some of it are very, very concerning. I mean, it's more of the same old same. I don't see in it any commitment at all to the types of changes that lots of us across the Irish spectrum of progressives, or whatever, the left, or that we would aim for. So I think the framework document itself was a political tool to get the talks going with one of the small parties, as they call them, whether the Greens, whether the Social Democrats, whether the Labour Party or others. And I think now they obviously have a hope of, you know, getting into some kind of rhythm of talks. And listen, I'm very conscious, like, I'm the leader of Sinn Féin. It's not my business to tell other parties or activists what to do. I don't roll like that, but it is incumbent on me to say this. Returning Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael together, the worst possible outcome of the election, like not what people voted for, is a roadway to more of the same. And I think activists and members and the leadership of parties that will engage perhaps in talks need to very honestly ask, is that what we need at this time? And I think anyone who reflects honestly and with the benefit of not just the last 4 years of government, but decades of government, I think would honestly say, no, that's not, it's the very thing that Ireland doesn't need right now.
Mary Lou MacDonald, that is a perfect summation in many ways. We won't agree on everything, and that nor should we, but that's part of the banter.
That's the beauty of it, yeah.
Can you give me a couple of minutes if I put a couple of listeners' questions to you quickly, if that's
absolutely,
okay?
Yeah.
Yeah, one quick one was in terms of what happened. You mentioned today the protest for Debenhams Online. These things now, the restrictions, if the government comes in to pass and we have to do that, where do you see the future for activism, if that's the way it's going to be?
Yeah, I think that's a very, very good question. I think in the here and now, the additional, you know, the restrictions in place and indeed the powers that have been given to the Gardaí, they're necessary. I'd certainly stand over them in the face of this pandemic, but they have to be used wisely and there has to be proportionately. And there has to be good judgment exercise. So I understand today that those Debenham workers who were out, I mean, they were physically distanced, the ones that they were masked and so on, and that the whole situation was handled very sensibly and very respectfully. And that's the way to go. It's not a social gathering. It's a legitimate protest by workers who have been treated disgracefully by Debenhams and whose worlds have fallen apart like so many others who have lost their jobs. So yes, that's in the here and now. Beyond that, you know, we are going to have to find ways as we live with precautions and limitations because of this virus. We're going to have to be creative in terms of how we make our democratic mark. And how we register our views, our presence, and our energy. Some of it will be in forms like this, Tony. So I think this is great. Like it was as the rally earlier on with the Debenhams workers. We were all saying, God, this is the first time I've been at a virtual rally. But it worked.
Yeah.
So we're going to have to readjust our own thinking. And then some stage we will get back to some kind of normal. The current emergency provisions are not forever. So I don't want anybody thinking, oh my God, this is some kind of Orwellian nightmare and it's going to be like this forever. That's not the case.
We can thank ICCL for that, and we can thank them for drafting the clause that went into the special
sunset
powers.
Clause. Just in terms of the, now that we have Fine Gael, as we're calling them, or Fianna, whatever way you want to say it, does that mean that finally we have a shifting in our traditional centre-right to centre-centre-right politics to a left-right divide in Irish politics?
Yes, I think we always had that, but we have it now finding expression in a way that's very, very evident in the Dáil. Yes is the answer to that.
Yeah.
And the question then arises, what do we do with that? How do we, if I can be a bit ironic here, how do we capitalise on that from the left?
We'll get t-shirts done and mugs, and we'll get it. if it's up to me, I'd be giving it. It's www.patreon.com/tortoiseshack. Look, just one other one is about the finger pointing that's gone on at citizens when we look at the back on the end of this, you know, the lack of PPE, the lack of preparedness, and the government actually has been pointed out, as Fintan O'Toole pointed out yesterday, they didn't even follow their own plan. This was the plan that was given to them. Now, I don't want to be the person that's kicking them in the middle of a global pandemic. That's not what this is about. But it's about saying, you know, let's talk about real transparency here. How do we feel about that as people have been left to sit at home for another 2 weeks?
Well, I said to you earlier, I think the finger pointing and the blame game and saying it's all the population's fault is just wrong. That's just wrong. You see, credit where it's due to everybody concerned, including those in the caretaker government, because the right approach was and is test, isolate, trace. Test, isolate, trace. That's it. That's what the science tells us. And it's not just the World Health Organization. It's way beyond that. And then the physical distancing measures and all of that was, well, you know, people have that, wash your hands, stay apart. I think all of that credit is due that the right model and approach was chosen, unlike London, who wanted to go on a different course. But it is true to say the big mistakes were made. I mean, the nursing homes, you know, the heartbreak there speaks for itself. Other residential settings, you know, we need to see what kind of stories emerge from those. But more importantly, we need to redeploy personnel, get the personal protective equipment in, do the testing in real time, get the results, not for some big epidemiological study or for data, but to enable us to intervene now in the here and now with real people to aid their recovery and to save lives. So, and then the testing piece. I mean, you can't have, well, our approach is to test, isolate and trace, but whoops, we don't have enough capacity to test. And I'm very mindful of, you know, kits and reagents and the fact that this is a global, I understand all of those, but it is the job of those who lead and those who are in charge to ensure that you can deliver the things in circumstances like this that we need. And actually, those are the deciding things. One of the deciding elements, apart from rates of infection, rates of hospitalization, how many are in ICU, all of which have to be measured and tracked, and the experts do that. You see, outside of that, it'll be, can we test? Can we isolate? Can we trace? Because once you start to unwind, you have to be sure on an ongoing basis that you can keep the curve low and that you can keep pace and keep ahead of this thing. And in the absence of that, it's very difficult to see how you unwind the emergency measures. Now, that's not Joe or Josephine citizens' fault.
No.
You know, and it's not fair to create a narrative, everything was going grand, but a couple of, and it's usually young people that are singled out, I think very unfairly. It was just that the youngsters wanted to have parties or raves or whatever. And I know, of course, that not everyone is playing ball, but the vast, vast, vast majority of people have been incredibly compliant. And I think if we deal with this properly, and if we show people the right level of respect, and we give people the information transparently, I think that people will stay the course.
Mary Lou, there's only one more question that we have, and it's basically, are you happy enough that Oliver Callan does good with the whole Instagram? And I'll send Oliver, this is important now, because I'll send him a text of this. Does he do a good impersonation?
Of whom? I think he does a great Dobbo. I think he is absolutely hilarious. I listen to it every, actually, we were only saying in my house, my husband, I was like, Jesus, you'd miss Callum, because at a time like this, you really need satire. We were talking about accountability. Yeah. Nothing makes a public figure accountable quicker than really good political satire. I'm not sure that he does my voice right, or maybe I'm just sensitive to that point. But no, I really, really enjoy him, and long may it continue. And sometimes I throw my eyes up to heaven and say, that fella's a complete brat. But every time I laugh heartily, I think he's brilliant. I agree with you.
Outside of me, he's the second best political commentator in Ireland. I agree with you wholeheartedly.
We are delighted to see, and we didn't mention at all, we are delighted to see you looking well. It is hard to imagine a political landscape in Ireland without Mary Lou MacDonald. It's impossible. It's impossible to imagine that space not being filled. It's impossible to imagine it. And thanks for all your work.
Well, thanks very much, Mark. And I'm delighted. I had a rough couple of weeks, but this is my second week back now. So I'm tipping away great. We're flying. We are incredibly busy. And I'm delighted to be back. And, you know, I very much hope now over the next number of weeks, notwithstanding the kind of difficulties that we have because of the restrictions, that all of us can keep in touch, and above all, that we will always keep the faith.
Thank you. I think that's a great place to leave it. Thanks. Listen, guys, I really appreciate you joining us. It means a lot to us that you guys are the people who helped keep this show on the road.
Yeah.
We want to do more of these. It is, I know we joked about it earlier, but this isn't free. This, we have to put the work in. Mary Lou MacDonald, thank you for your time. And if you
thank
want to
you.
Come on up, talk to you all soon, folks. Take care. Bye-bye.